All right. Once again, this is our blessing. We appreciate everyone who's made it out tonight. And if this is your first time here, is it your first time here? I don't see any first-time faces, do I? All right. It's been a blessing. Blessing, grace upon grace, each step of the way. And with the details of the campaign of Armageddon last night and all of the plans of Satan and what he's trying to accomplish to hinder the Lord's second advent, we are ready for our final session this evening. Arnold.
All right, let's turn our outlines to page 7 and your Bibles to Genesis chapter 12. Way back in 1962, I was a senior in high school in West L.A. As graduation time was approaching, I began to write to different colleges requesting their catalogs. I was looking for a school to allow me to major in both Hebrew and Greek at the same time. I did find a school that had a double major that way, and that's where I chose to go. But I also knew there'd be other courses I would have to be taking outside my area of interest. So as these catalogs were coming in, I would see what the required courses they would make you take. And after a while, in the philosophy segments of several of these college catalogs, I would notice how two different courses were being offered. And they were always listed as separate and distinct courses, but to me they seemed to be the same course with the words inverted. Because one course was called the History of Philosophy, and the second course was called the Philosophy of History. And that inversion made no sense to me at that point in my life. Then 2 years passed, and I was sitting in the course they used to make everybody take in my day called the History, the Introduction to Philosophy. And that's when the textbook and the professor explained to us the differences between the two courses. The course that was called the History of Philosophy was primarily historical. We went right through history, and the textbook and the professor explained to us how different men throughout history tried to explain the meaning of life and the source of knowledge and other questions that philosophy wrestles with. The second course that was called the Philosophy of History was mostly philosophical. It too would look over history, but what it would try to do is extract from history a principle by which history could be understood. Then based upon one's conclusions, he would take his principle of his philosophy of history, apply it to the future, and predict the future turning out along certain lines. That's when I first learned that communism was more than just a political system in East Europe. It was also very much a specific philosophy of history. It sees history evolving as an eventual revolution of the working classes against the ruling ones and then synthesizing into a socialistic state. When the communist takes his principle of his philosophy of history, he saw the world evolving into a one-world socialistic system of some kind. Now, last studies on how to destroy the Jews, and any question that deals with Jewish survival or Jewish destruction concerns itself with every specific philosophy found in the scriptures. But given a message that title has in the past gotten me into some rather interesting situations, especially if it was advertised in a newspaper in a city with a sizable Jewish community. Wouldn't it be unusual on this occasion to find members of the B'nai B'rit Anti-Defamation League coming out, members of the Jewish Defense League coming out to see what this new neo-Nazi movement might be all about? My most interesting experience when I gave a similar talk, it wasn't really the exact same message, but the title was the same on behalf of Campus Crusade at the University of Texas in Arlington. About a week before my arrival, Crusade staff put up posters all over the campus announcing I was coming to speak on the topic of how to destroy the Jews. The purpose was to attract some of the Jewish students on the campus to come out and hear the gospel. After a week of this advertising, I walked into a meeting hall. There were about 200 students there, but not one single Jewish student came out to find out how to destroy the Jews. But 4 Arab students came out to find out how. When I was finished, y'all came up to me with a few choice words for me. I'll tell you about them a bit later in our study. Now, the principle of God's philosophy of history is found when God makes Abraham a covenant in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. In this passage, God promises Abram three basic things. The first of all will come forth from him, a people or a nation. Secondly, to this nation God promises a land. And concerning them, God says, I will bless them that bless you, but whom curses you will I curse. The people have come forth from Abram, we call today the Jewish people. A very simple but biblical definition as to what is a Jew. A Jew is any descendant of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. It also has descendants of Jews. It is irrelevant what the individual Jew may believe or disbelieve. He cannot change the fact of his Jewish identity. He may choose to be Orthodox, conservative, or Reform. He may choose to be an atheist or an agnostic. He may choose to believe in the Messiahship of Jesus. Nothing can change the fact of his Jewish identity. Secondly, to this nation, God promises a land in the days of Genesis called the land of Canaan. To much of the last 2,000 years, the land of Palestine, among the Jewish people, always called the land of Israel. Here again, it is irrelevant whether Jews happen to be in the land or outside the land. By divine grant, the land belongs to Jewish people. But for our purpose tonight, we're going to be focusing on the third statement he makes in verse 3. I will bless them that bless you, and him that curses you will I curse. So very early in human history, God lays down this principle of his philosophy of history, that those who bless the Jews will be blessed, but those who curse the Jews will be cursed. We can call verse 3 God's foreign policy to the Gentiles in their relationship to the Jewish people. We shall largely do this evening is to go through various parts of Scripture, and we shall see how this principle works out on two different levels. First of all, how it works out on an individual level in the lives of various individuals, and secondly, on a national level in the history of various nations. On the individual level of the covenant, capital B in your outline, we come to chapter 12, verses 10 through 20, where it begins to work out immediately. Shortly after his arrival in the land, a great famine hits the land. Abram's faith had not yet matured to the point that he realized that he could trust God in any situation. Learning that the famine has not affected Egypt, he chooses to go down to Egypt to be sustained. Whether he already knew this or he found out about it on the way to Egypt, he came to realize there was one quirk in the Egyptian moral system. On the positive side, the Egyptians were quite negative towards adultery, and no self-respecting Egyptian wanted to be guilty of adultery. Thinking on the other side of the coin. Suppose an Egyptian saw a woman he really wanted, but she was already married. He would not want to be guilty of adultery. She would arrange for the husband to be murdered. Even though she's a widow, there's no moral problem with marrying a widow. And because of that quirk, he decides to pass off his wife as his sister, which was partially true. She was his half-sister, but the intent was to hide the fact she was also his wife. And what he feared did happen, when Pharaoh hears about Sarah's beauty, he takes her into his harem. And now note verse 17. And Jehovah plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Although it is Abram who is at fault here, because he did the lying, because of the covenantal relationship, God will still intervene on Abram's behalf. Intervenes enough for him to save his wife, and shortly thereafter, the family is expelled from Egypt. Now skip over to chapter 20, we'll see the same thing happening again, except the different king and different nation are involved. Chapter 20, verse 1. And Abraham journeyed from thence to the land of the Negev. He dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Once again, the same half-truth and half-lie is told. Once again, the result is the same. Abraham's wife is taken away from him and put into the king's harem. And once again, because of God's covenantal relationship, he intervenes. And verse 3 says, But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, Behold, you are but a dead man, because of the woman you have taken, for she is a man's wife. There are certain things happening behind the scenes we should not miss. Now, contained within the overall framework of the Abrahamic covenant was another promise that God will someday bless the Gentile world through the seed of Abraham. But this seed was to come by means of only one woman, and that was Sarah. By means of only one of Abraham's eight sons, and that would be Isaac. From Isaac, the seed will continue until it culminated in the person of the Messiah through whom the Gentiles will receive the blessing. The events of chapters 12 and 20 occur before the birth of Isaac. What we should observe here is Satan's first attempt to destroy the Jews by keeping Isaac from being born, because if he can keep Isaac from being born, the Jewish people will die out with the death of Abraham. Now again, the principle of God's philosophy of history is, I will bless them that bless you, him that curses you will I curse. But from this overall principle, there's a little sub-principle that develops rather consistently, a sub-principle I call curse for curse in kind. Curse for curse in kind. What I mean by that is this. The way the Jew is cursed, God will take the same curse and apply it to one doing the cursing. The specific curse here is to try to destroy the nation by keeping birth from taking place. And God does curse the house of Abimelech, but exactly how does he do so? Verse 3 did not spell it out, but verse 18 does. Chapter 20, verse 18, For Jehovah had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And now it is the household of Abimelech that faces the danger of extinction because of the inability of the woman in that household to give birth to children. But Sarah is rescued. In chapter 21, Isaac is born, the seed continues, an early attempt to destroy the Jews has failed. The examples of chapters 12 and 20 are both examples of the cursing facet of the Abrahamic covenant, but a blessing facet has also begun to work. We'll look at the first example in chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30, verse 25, And it came to pass when Rachel had born Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, Send me away that I may go unto mine own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children where I have served you, and let me go. For you know my service where I have served you. And to begin with, we should make no mistake as the kind of individual that Laban was. Laban was not a worshiper of the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Laban was a pagan who worshipped many gods. He had many idols in his home. So when Jacob, his nephew, came to work for him, and Jacob worshipped this one God, Jehovah, Laban, a very ecumenical type individual, was quite happy to include Jehovah among the many gods he already had. One more God couldn't hurt. As time progressed, he began to recognize something. Verse 27, Laban sent him, If I have found favor in your right staying, for I have divined that Jehovah have blessed me for your sake. In the course of time, this pagan began to recognize that his God of Jacob, whoever he might be, was blessing him because of his relationship to Jacob the Jew. A question sometimes raised in circles of believers, does God ever bless the ungodly? To some extent, the answer is yes. Now, there are certain blessings of God which are conditioned upon the spiritual state of the recipients, but there are other blessings of God which are conditioned upon other matters, and blessings available by means of and through the Abrahamic covenant will be conditioned in a proper relationship with the Jewish population in the midst. We now move on to chapter 39 in the life of Joseph. In chapter 39, verses 1 through 5, Joseph is sold into Egypt. He's purchased by an officer of Pharaoh's who initially makes him one of several slaves. When he recognized Joseph's unique administrative abilities, he put him in charge of the affairs of both his household and the field. And now look at verse 5, chapter 39, verse 5. And it came to pass some day time that he made him overseer in his house, and all that he had, that Jehovah blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of Joseph upon all that he had in the house and in the field. Once again, we find God blessing a pagan Egyptian this time because of his relationship to Joseph the Jew. The book of Genesis is called the Book of the Beginnings because we have contained within it the beginnings of many things, one of which is this. We have here the beginnings of the outworking of the Abrahamic covenant, both in the blessing and cursing facets, as they work their way out in the lives of those individuals who come in contact with the few Jews living at this point of Jewish history. Go on to page 8 of your outlines, and now go to the book of Exodus, chapter 1. We'll now leave the individual level of the outworking of the covenant and see how it works out at a national level in the history of various nations. Chapter 1, verse 8. Now there was a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. He said to his people, Behold, the people of children of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that if there falls out any war, they also join themselves unto enemies, fight against us, and give them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them. But because what's happening in this chapter, Egypt has a very unique distinction, in that it's the first nation that can be called anti-Semitic, in the way we use that term today. In the first phase of Egypt's curse against Israel, she puts the Jews into slavery. But as time progresses, this will not be enough. And in verses 15 to 22, and a second phase is initiated. The king of Egypt instructs the Jewish midwives that when they see the mothers giving birth to baby boys, they are to kill the baby boys as they're coming out of the womb, something the Jewish midwives refuse to do. So in verse 22, the command goes all-inclusive. And Pharaoh charges all his people, saying, Every son that's born, he shall cast into the river, every daughter he shall save alive. Not only is Egypt the first anti-Semitic nation, it's also the first nation to attempt genocide, the total annihilation of the Jewish people. And the method of Egypt is to kill the sons, and the means by which these Jewish sons were killed was by means of drowning. In this manner, the curse of Egypt has been set down against the people of Israel. At this point of time, or this time around, God chooses to allow the situation to continue for the lengthy period of time. And perhaps if I was among the Jews living after this long duration of time, I might have given up on this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I may have gladly consented to stories that my father or grandfather may have told me about what this God once did for our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But so what? What good is this covenant doing us today? We've been slaves to Egyptians for a long time, and now with the new edict from Pharaoh, every time a boy is born, we have to hide him from the Egyptian search parties, lest they find him and drown him in our river. What good is this covenant doing us today? There's a second principle that will develop from the overall principle, and the second principle teaches this. That while from a human perspective, God sometimes appears to wait not for a long time before fulfilling his promises, yet sooner or later those promises are kept. They're kept every letter of that promise. In chapter 4, verse 22, God begins his work of intervention, but now notice, Yahweh working the first sub-principle of curse for curse in kind. Chapter 4, verse 22, You shall say unto Pharaoh, Thus says the Jehovah, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And I have said unto you, Let my son go, that he may serve me. And you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. The curse of Egypt against Israel is the death of the sons of Israel. And now God will send 10 plagues upon the Egyptians. And what is the last plague? The death of the firstborn son of every Egyptian family. That's curse for curse in kind. But it will not stop there. The means by which these Jewish sons were killed was by means of drowning. And when Pharaoh, as the Jews begin to make their way out of Egypt, Pharaoh will change his mind and send his army against the Jews. And how does God deal with the Egyptian army? Also by means of drowning. Here again it is curse for curse in kind. Another way of trying to destroy the Jews has also failed. Shortly after the Exodus, in chapter 17 of the same book, another nation called Amalek comes in with its own method of Jewish destruction. Chapter 17, verse 8, then came Amalek and warred with Israel and Rephidim. Amalek's method is to declare war upon the Jews. Let's skip down to verse 14. And Jehovah said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in the book, and rehearse in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Verse 16, he said, Jehovah hath sworn, Jehovah hath warred Amalek from generation to generation. In verse 8, Amalek declared war upon the Jews, so now in verse 16, God declares war upon Amalek, in the curse for curse in kind principle. And once again, God waits a long time, this time waits 4 centuries, before the war actually comes to an end. The war begins here in Exodus 17 and continues all the way to 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Only when Israel has its first king, King Saul, the first king of Israel, is given a commission. But the origins of that commission go back to Exodus 17. 1 Samuel 15, verse 1. And Samuel said to Saul, Jehovah sent me to anoint you to be king over his people of Israel. Now therefore hearken unto the voice of the words of Jehovah. Thus says Jehovah of hosts, I have mocked that which Amalek did to Israel, how he set himself against him in the way when he came up out of Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and spared them not. Although the war was declared 4 centuries earlier, God says, I mocked it down so it could not be forgotten, and the mocking down was in the context of the Exodus passage. And now he becomes the first king of Israel. He's commissioned to bring the war to an end, and he goes out to do just that. But as he goes out to do just that, he runs into one small problem. 4 centuries earlier, when these Amalekites had cursed the Jews, there was another nation called the Kenites. At the same point of history, the Kenites had blessed the Jews. So you have 2 peoples, one under the curse, one under the blessing. But by the time Saul becomes the king of Israel, the Kenites, under the blessing, lived among the Amalekites under the curse. In those days, war was largely hand-to-hand combat. In that kind of a context, you did not have time to ask for identification papers, passports, driver licenses, or whatever. That's a problem he faces, but it's a problem he solves in verse 5. And Saul came to the city of Amalek, but laid wait in the valley. And Saul said unto the Kenites, go, depart, get you down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. And why? For ye showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed among the Amalekites. What's good about 1 Samuel 15 is this. In one chapter, you can see both facets of the Abrahamic covenant, the blessing and cursing facets, working their way out in the history of 2 nations because of actions by these nations 4 centuries earlier. We now move on to the book of Esther. The book of Esther, in a unique way, portrays the outworking of the Abrahamic covenant. Look at several segments of Esther, beginning with the 3rd chapter. As most of you probably know, Esther has this one usual feature about it. Try as you may, you won't find God mentioned anywhere in this book. There's no mention of him, no reference to him. The more time I've spent studying the book, the more convinced that the author of the book is deliberately going out of his way to avoid mentioning God. For example, there is a situation in the book where Mordecai, The real hero in the book is arguing with Esther to do something to help the Jews out of a serious predicament. And his words to Esther are, "If you do not help us, help will come from another place." These two words, "another place," is as close as this book will come to any possible reference to God. The author has gone well out of his way to avoid mentioning God. Now, if that's true, why is this book in Holy Scripture? Although God is not mentioned, we'll see God working, but note as we proceed, God is not working just any old way. He's working in a very specific way. He's working the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. We did need at least one example in Scripture that shows how God works providentially in place of direct intervention. And since most of history does work providentially, this book shows how that principle works. In chapter 3, verse 1, the Jews find themselves with a brand new enemy. After these things, the king Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced them and set a seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed down and did reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not down, nor did him reverence. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not down, nor in reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. But he thought scornfully hence that Mordecai loved him, and not him, the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Because one Jew will not bend his knees to him, Haman gets sore, mad, and angry. He so incensed he will not be satisfied to get even with the one Jew who made him angry. He's so mad he wants to wipe out all the Jews of the Persian Empire, which at the same time would mean all the Jews of the world. The whole world Jewish population at this point of history lived within the confines of the Persian Empire. Now his method spelled out a bit later in verses 12 and 13, and briefly it's this. He writes out a decree and he seals it with the king's ring, and that will mean something significant. And then this decree is sent out through the entire bureaucracy of the Persian Empire, and the content of this decree says, upon a certain day of a certain month, very soon to come, the Jews become legal game for enemies. If anyone so desires, they can go and kill the Jews and suffer no legal penalties for it. And to motivate people to kill the Jews, the decree goes on to say, those who kill the Jews will then have automatic rights to take over the material possessions of the Jews they killed. And he seals it with the king's ring. Under Persian law, any decree that was sealed with the king's ring could never be repealed, and not even the emperor of Persia had the power or the authority to repeal a decree that was sealed with his ring, even if someone else happened to use his ring to do so, which is the case right here. Haman is not the king, but he has the usage of the king's ring. And so now the stage is set. Upon a certain day of a certain month soon to come, the Jews become legal game for enemies. And his method is to make anti-Semitism the official government policy of the Persian Empire. You would think that would satisfy one anti-Semite. What more could any anti-Semite want than a sentence of death upon the whole Jewish population? But he's still not satisfied. And the reason for his dissatisfaction is he wants to turn Mordecai's death into some kind of a public spectacle, public example, doesn't quite know how to go about doing so. He thinks about it throughout chapter 4 and comes up with no solutions. So in chapter 5, he goes to one person that he knows could give him some sound and morbid advice along these lines, and that one person turns out to be his wife. In chapter 5, verse 13, notice what this lovely woman has to say. "Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then said Zeres his wife and all his friends unto him, "Let gallows be made 50 cubits high. In the morning speak unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged therein." Thereon they were merrily with the king on the banquet. The thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. A lovely woman indeed this one is. She says, "Haman, honey, go out back and build a hangman's noose 50 cubits high. Now, the significance of 50 cubits is to be the highest single structure in the whole capital city of Shushan. No matter where you live in the city, you can see what dangles from these gallows because of its height. So build the gallows 50 cubits high and then get a good night's sleep. Tomorrow morning, just go over to the king's palace and request permission to hang Mordecai on it. Now, Haman is the second top man in the government at this point of time. The king would honor a simple request like this. And we're told that the advice pleased him. He has the gallows built and then has a good night's sleep. Now, for five chapters, notice things are getting progressively worse for the Jews, not one whit better. But chapter 6 opens up with one crucial phrase. On that night. On what night? On the same night that's gotten as bad as it could get. On that night when there's a sentence of death hanging over the world Jewish population. On that night when Haman has built a gallows for Mordecai. On that night when Haman could sleep. Verse 1 says, on that night could not the king sleep. Here are the beginnings of God's providential intervention. It is God who is giving the king some royal divine insomnia. The sometime before all this ever occurred, Mordecai saved his life. He did so by overhearing a conspiracy of assassination and reporting to the proper authorities. But most people did not know that. Haman didn't know that. But the scribe who was responsible to maintain the historical records of the Persian Empire wrote the facts into the chronicles of the Persian Empire, but there it lay for some time. Now, on this night, the king could not sleep. When I was a boy growing up in Brooklyn, New York, I would sometimes have the same problem and wouldn't be able to sleep. As we say back then, when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn. On those occasions, my mother would come into my bedroom, read me some bedtime stories that would normally do the trick. Well, the Emperor of Persia was just like me when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn. He cannot sleep, so he wants some bedtime stories read to him. And guess what his favorite bedtime story happens to be? Stories about himself. Stories that's been happening around here since he took the throne. He does have a sense of humility along these lines. The servants come in, they begin to read the Chronicles of the Persian Empire. As they read, they come to a paragraph that reported how Mordecai saved his life. And the king wants to know, have we rewarded him for this? And they say, no, nothing's been done for the good deed that Mordecai did. Well, that's no good, says the king. I'm going to have to think up of a nice reward for Mordecai. I'll sleep on it, and now you can sleep. Now, if you don't believe that God has a sense of humor, you'd never studied the book of Esther. You really need a Jewish sense of humor to appreciate this book, but a Gentile one won't hurt. In the middle of the night, the picture is this. Haman is sleeping here, the king is sleeping there, and they're both dreaming about the same Jew for two different reasons. This one wants to kill him, this one wants to reward him. Morning comes, and Haman gets up, starts walking to the king's palace, but the king is still wondering, what in the world could he do about a nice reward for Mordecai? And that's what he's thinking about when he sees Haman coming into the front gate, and of course Haman's coming in to hang the man. But when the king sees him coming, he says to himself, there's a smart man, I'll ask him what I should do. And that brings us to verse 6 of chapter 6. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what shall be done unto a man whom the king likes to honor? Now Haman said to himself, to whom would the king like to do honor more than to myself? Can you see Haman's humility coming through in this one verse? One simple question, what should I do to a man I want to honor? Haman says to himself, who could that be? It's got to be me. This whole empire cannot think of anyone the king wants to honor more than me. And so you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to lay it on thick. Oh boy, am I going to lay it on thick. And then the king will say, well, you're the man, and I'll fake the surprised look on my face. Thus, we end up asking for in verses 7 through 8, three things. The king's horse, which today would be like asking for be able to fly Air Force One or the president's limousine. The king's clothes, and the king's crown. Very humble gifts here. But he doesn't stop. He says, let these three things be turned over. to one of your most noble princes, let this most noble prince dress the man you want to honor with the clothing and the crown. Then put him on the royal steed. Let him then release the horse to the streets of the capital, crying out, this is the way the king will treat a man he must honor. And him laid on nice and thick, he's now primed and ready to fake the surprised look on his face. I happen to like living in the days in which I live. Even as a child, I don't recall wanting to go back into time, but if I ever do, I think I'll pick verse 10 of chapter 6. Then the king said to Haman, make haste, and take the apparel and the horse as you have said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that you have spoken. The surprised look on Haman's face was not faked. He came in that day for the intent of hanging Mordecai. He'll be the one to dress him in the clothing and the crown. He'll put him on the steed. He'll lead the horse to the capital, crying, God, this is the way the king will treat the man he must honor. And God's begun his work of intervention by humbling Haman, but eventually it's always going to be curse for curse in kind. Go down to chapter 7, verse 10. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. The gallows built for Mordecai, from those gallows he himself hangs. And because of its extreme height, at his own wife's advice, everybody can see who's been turned into a public spectacle in his death. That's curse for curse in kind. This won't solve the problem of the book. Because remember, a decree was issued that could not be repealed, and although the author of the decree is now dead, the content still stands. It was sealed with the king's ring. Now, because that decree could not be repealed, in chapter 8, they issue a second decree, also sealed with the king's ring. And decree number 2 says, upon that same day of the same month, the Jews are free to take up weapons and defend themselves. And the conclusion comes in chapter 9, verse 5. And the Jews smote all those enemies with stroke of the sword, and with slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto them that hated them. Those desired to kill the Jews by the sword, or by the sword killed themselves. Here again, curse for curse in kind. But the grand finale comes a bit late in verse 26. Verse 26, wherefore they call these days Purim, after the name of Purim. A new Jewish holiday is now inaugurated, not one that began with Moses like the others, but one that began in the days of Mordecai and Esther, still observed each year by the Jewish people, remembering the livings of the Jews from the hand of Haman. Now, 2,500 years later, there was a small sequel to the story. The editor of the Nazi press was a man named Julius Streicher. And because of his position as the editor of the Nazi press, he was able to spread hatred against the Jews both inside and outside of Germany. After World War II, he was captured by the Allied forces, tried in Nuremberg, and then sentenced to be hung. When he sent the scaffold, he said his last words, which were Purim 1946. Purim 1946. On the last day of his life, Julius Streicher recognized the role he played in history, the role of Haman. In closing moments of his life, he also realized the Jews would now celebrate his failure as we have observed the failure of Haman for the last 2,500 years. Now, with the book of Esther, we come to the end of Old Testament history, and so far, notice, we have not as yet answered the question, which was how destroyed the Jews. We have learned so far of four methods that cannot and will not work. It will not work, for example, to take the wives away, or to kill the sons, or to make anti-Semitism the official government policy, or declare war upon the Jews. These four methods cannot and will not work. And from biblical times to modern times, all attempts to destroy the Jews are simply used and reused these same four methods that cannot work. For example, the Crusaders took the wives away. The Spanish and Portuguese empires killed the sons. Nazi Germany made anti-Semitism its government policy. In the United States, on four occasions, declared war upon the Jews. These four methods cannot and will not work. Now, there is one method that, if it is ever used, will succeed. There is one method that will work. I'm just not quite ready to tell you what that method is. I will before we're done tonight, and then after services, I'll be driving back to San Antonio. Now we're going to skip down to Kalpali. Now what we see throughout history is the same four methods used, and we see the same principle of curse for kin continuing. Let's go down to Kalpali, and I'll just use examples 3 and 4. Now, September 1, 1939, the Second World War began with the Nazi invasion of Poland. After Poland collapsed, other nations were invaded and occupied. The Nazis would capture major cities such as Warsaw. They would collect Jews from all outlying regions and crowd them into some section of the city. Within these concrete walled in ghettos, the Jews were systematically killed till 6 million died. 17 were members of my own family. The Gestapo, Nazi secret police, enjoyed playing various games with the Jews. Among their favors was to take one Jewish man and force him to kill other Jewish men, thinking he could save the lives of his wife and children being held hostage by the Gestapo. And these games of terror continued for 6 years till 1945, and now Germany was being invaded and occupied by the armies of the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, and the USA. And the people that once built concrete walls around the Jews had a concrete wall that split in two the capital city of Berlin. And the people that once had Jews kill Jews had Germans kill Germans along the Berlin Wall and the entire border area between East and West Germany. And for one generation, experienced the curse for curse in kind principle. Now, another example in point 4 is what happened as a little student at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. In May of 1967, four Arab states, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, combined together for the express purpose of destroying the Jewish state. I lived only 4 blocks from the border that cut Jerusalem in two back then, and because of my proximity to the Arab army, I would turn my radio station on to see what the Arab broadcasts were saying. About 2 weeks before fighting erupted, now Nasser was then the Pharaoh of Egypt. He said he would now drive all the Jews of Israel into the Sea of the Mediterranean. We have to swim across the Mediterranean to Europe. Being a 5'4" Jewish kid that could not swim that well, I wouldn't appreciate that threat at all. Then about 4 or 5 days later, King Hussein of Jordan spoke on the radio and he said he would now encompass all of what he called occupied Palestine. What he meant by that is he would move the Jordanian border and annex all of the territory to be part of the kingdom of the Jordan. Now, these threats continued until June 5th. On Monday morning of June the 5th, as I was heading for my classes that morning, suddenly sirens rang out informing us the fighting had finally erupted. After 4 days of fighting, it was not the Jews who were swimming across the Mediterranean, but the Egyptians were swimming across the Suez Canal, heading back into Egypt. Curse for curse in kind. As for the King Hussein, he did speak the truth. His border was moved, but it got moved in the opposite direction. In place of annexing Jewish territory, now his territory was now under annexation. Now, King Hussein was a Muslim. By Islamic law, he could not sing Christian hymns, but this is one Christian hymn that you may know that you could sing rather honestly. It's found in most of your traditional hymn books. And the first verse goes something like this. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand, and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie. The Muslim could sing that one rather honestly. Page 9. Russia has had a long history of anti-Semitism. But Ezekiel 38:39 has already prophesied they'll overstep themselves and invade Israel. And once the armies enter the center of Israel, God will so deal with them that the whole army will be destroyed. He'll rain fire and brimstone upon the land of Russia itself, at least in the territory of southern Russia, and between the area of the Caspian and Black Seas, and they will also suffer the consequences. Leaving the final conflict we looked at in detail last night, Armageddon, in the 2 Zechariah passages, what we noted last night was this. What triggers this with national salvation and the second coming is when all the armies of all the world come together against the Jewish people to conflict and to destroy them. That will trigger Israel's national salvation, the second coming. Even Armageddon is the ultimate outworking of the Abrahamic covenant. But again, I've not yet answered the question, which was how to destroy the Jews. Turn now to Jeremiah 31. Could somebody give me a little bit of more water? One of the most vocal people calling upon Israel's destruction is Osama bin Laden today and Ahmadinejad, of the president of Iran. If they really want to get serious about the whole thing, here is all they need to do. Jeremiah 31 and verse 35. Thus says Jehovah, who gives the sun for light by day, and the ordinances of the moon of the stars for light by night, who stirs up the seas to the raves thereof, the Jehovah of hosts is his name. Now notice, if these ordinances, what ordinances? The sun, moon, and stars of the previous verse. If these ordinances depart from before me, says Jehovah, then the seed of Israel also cease from being a nation before me forever. If these guys want to get serious, here's all they need to do. They must begin by building a fantastically huge rocket with the biggest nuclear warhead ever known to man. Then fire it, not towards Israel, that will not do it, but towards the sun, till the sun has been totally destroyed. Then they'll have to build a second one, smaller, won't have to go as far, aim it for the moon, till the moon itself is destroyed. After they've destroyed both the sun and the moon, then comes the hard part. They need to build billions and billions and billions more of these rockets, much bigger than the one they used to wipe out the sun, aim for every single star in the universe until every single star has been destroyed. Then God promises, don't forget, God always is careful to keep his promises, then God promises the Jews can be destroyed, but not before then. I shared that method at the University of Texas meeting, and afterwards all four Arab students came up to me, and the spokesman said to me, there's got to be an easier way. Now, how does all this relate to us as a local church? How does this relate to us as individual believers? I want to conclude the conference answering those questions in that order. Let's begin by turning to Romans passage, Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Now, the Matthew 28 passage on your outline, verses 18 to 20, the Great Commission emphasizes that we are obligated to begin to proclaim the gospel throughout the whole world. But Romans chapter 1, verse 16 gives us the procedure by which this should be accomplished. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. There's only one verb that controls the last two clauses, and it's the verb is, Greek present tense, emphasizing continuous action. And the point is this: the gospel is continuously God's power to save, therefore continuously the Jew first, also a Greek. If we try to reinterpret this, as some have, that this means that it used to be that way but no longer, the verse would then have to mean that the gospel used to be God's power to save but no longer. But if it's always God's power to save, it's always the Jew first, also a Greek. This applies to both active and passive evangelism. Active evangelism is when you do the work of an evangelist, and passive evangelism is when you support those doing the work of evangelism, actively or passively, is to go out to you first. It applies regardless of the specific method of evangelism, whether it's person-to-person, door-to-door, radio, TV, or whatever. It also applies regardless of specific individual calling. Because people have said to me, it's one thing for me to follow the principle because I am involved in full-time Jewish ministries, but does this apply to someone called to a different people group? Well, Paul answers that in chapter 11 of the same book. Chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 13, 11:13. But I speak to you who are Gentiles, inasmuch as I am apostle of Gentiles, I glorify my ministry, if by any means I may provoke to jealousy them that are my flesh, and may save some of them. Here Paul tells us that he was not called to do the work of Jewish evangelism. That was Peter's calling, not Paul's. He was called to go through Gentiles. Galatians 2, passage verses 7 to 9, we learned there are two types of missions, not home missions and foreign missions, but Jewish missions and Gentile missions. And they kept this thing because there's different kinds of purposes involved. And while Peter was called to do the work among the circumcision, Paul was to call him to do the same work among the uncircumcision. Brad Fail, everywhere he goes, he's very careful to go to the Jew first. Now turn with me to Acts 13, where we'll see this principle in action as far as active evangelism when you do the work of an evangelist. When Paul was called to be the apostle of the Gentiles, that first happened in chapter 9 of the book. But only as of Acts 13, verses 1 through 3, is he called upon, is he sent out by the elders of the church of Antioch, who is a member, to do just that. So as of Acts 13, the apostle of the Gentiles goes out to the Gentiles, but notice the procedure he's careful to use. Verse 5, and when they're at Salamis, they proclaim the word of God in the synagogue of the Jews. Verse 14, but they passing through from Perga came to Antioch of Pisidium, and they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. In the following verses, the gospel is proclaimed. And now look at verse 46. Verse 46, and Paul and Barnabas spoke out boldly and said, it was necessary that the word of God should first be spoken to you. Notice the words, it was necessary. Yes, that was not it wasn't his preference, as some say. It was a necessity. But what kind of necessity was it? A biblical theological necessity in light of Romans 1:16. Chapter 14, verse 1. And it came to pass in Iconium that they entered together in the synagogue of the Jews, and so spake the great multitude, both of Jews and the Greeks, believed. Chapter 16, verse 12. And Bethesda Philippi, which is the city of Macedonia, the first of the district of Roman Kingdom, in the city tearing certain days. And the Sabbath day went forth outside the gate of Riverside, we knew there was a place of prayer. Now up until now, his basic procedure was to go to New City and go right to the synagogue to get the gospel to the Jewish community first. He could not do so in Philippi because the Jewish community in Philippi was too small to finance a synagogue. Now Paul was a former Pharisee. He knew the Jewish custom was that if you were in a city that didn't have a synagogue, the Jews were to gather at the water source of the city for the Sabbath prayer meeting. But that was several days away. In the meantime, he could have gone ahead and spread the gospel among the Gentiles, but doesn't say he did so. It simply says he stayed put for several days, not saying anything. He waits until the Sabbath, then goes out to where he knew the Jews would come to make sure they got the gospel first. Chapter 17, verse 1. And when they passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was the synagogue of the Jews, and Paul, as his custom was, went in unto them, and for three Sabbath days reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Verse 10. And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea, who, when they were come thither, went to the synagogue of the Jews. Verse 16. Now Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked with him, as he beheld the city full of idols. We're about to see another example how careful he is to keep that principle of Romans 1:16. When he comes into Athens, he sees the whole city given over to idolatry. He's provoked to those who worship these idols. But who worships these idols? Not the Jews of Athens. Idolatry ceased being a Jewish problem after the Babylonian captivity. But the Gentiles of Athens who worship these idols, and to these Gentiles he's provoked to preach. But the principle of Romans 1:16 must stand. So he says in verse 17, so, he was in the synagogue with the Jews. The Jew first in verse 17, and in verse 18, the idol worshiping Greeks. Chapter 18, verse 1. In verse 1, he comes to Corinth, and verse 4 says, he's in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded Jews and Greeks. Go to page 10, your last page. Chapter 18, verse 19. They came to Ephesus, he left them there, being seven to the synagogue, and reasoned with the Jews. He now leaves Ephesus. In chapter 19, verse 1, he comes back to Ephesus, and verse 8 says, entered the synagogue and spake boldly for the space of 3 months, reasoning and persuading as to things concerning the kingdom of God. Because even when he comes back to a city the second time, he's still careful to go out to the Jew first. Chapter 28. That comes into Rome in verse 17. It came to pass that after 3 days he called together those that were chief of the Jews, and the gospel was proclaimed to them. Rome did have a synagogue, but he comes to Rome as a prisoner under house arrest. He's not free to get to the synagogue. He knows he'll have a 2-year ministry within the prison work of Rome. So they make sure they got the gospel first. He called the Jewish leaders to his house in prison area to make sure they got the gospel first. Raphael, where he goes to the Jew first, although a specific call was to do Gentile evangelism. Now turn to Romans 15. We have an example of passive evangelism. To the Jew first, we support those doing such a work. Romans 15, verse 25. Romans 15, verse 25. But now I say, I go unto Jerusalem, minister unto the saints, for it hath been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. So far, what he's been telling us is that these Gentile Greek churches have been collecting funds to support the Church of Jerusalem that become poverty stricken. Now, is this just a goodwill gesture? Was it showing Christian love? No doubt that's part of it, but there's a theological issue in verse 27. Yea, it had been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. For the Gentiles have been made partakers of their, meaning Jewish, spiritual things. They were to them to minister unto them in material things. Notice the contrast between the spiritual and material. He points out the Gentile believers now partaking of the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. As if you're a Gentile believer, you're partaking of the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. But Paul points out that puts Gentiles in a state of indebtedness. Fortunately, he also tells us how to get out of debt. You don't want to go to heaven still in debt, do you? And the way you pay off your debt is sharing materially with Jewish ministries. Now, what these passages show is that there are certain blessings of God that go out to every local church where the Bible is proclaimed in its purity and people hold down to the fundamentals of the Word of God. As we saw tonight, there's also other blessings available by other means. A blessing available by means of the Abrahamic covenant will be going out to both individuals and churches that will carry out the principle of Romans 1:16. When the work of evangelism is done, they carry out the work to the Jew first. And in passive evangelism, it shows that everyone who's a Gentile believer should find a Jewish ministry to support. If you cannot think of a good Jewish ministry to support, there is one I can highly recommend. But I will not make this self-serving. The obligation to support the Jewish ministry is found here, but which one you choose to support is between you and the Lord. That's how we get local churches can become participants in the blessing facets of the Abrahamic covenant. As far as individuals, let's look at the last passage on your outline, Psalm 122. Psalm 122. Psalm 122, verse 6. Psalm 122, verse 6. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem, they shall prosper, they love you. And notice the verse begins with an imperative to pray or to seek Jerusalem's peace. And those who will make the peace of Jerusalem part of their prayer life are promised blessings not available by other means. Now, what should be obvious from our previous 4 studies is this. The peace of Jerusalem will not come until the second coming, and the prerequisite to the second coming, this was national salvation. The practical way of praying for the peace of Jerusalem is to pray for the salvation of Jewish people, and also prays for it so regularly, a promised blessing not available by other means. And thus, an individual believer can become participant in the blessing aspects of the Jewish covenants, and especially the Abrahamic covenant. This concludes our series for this occasion. Hopefully we can do this again in the near future. A few announcements. If anybody here has felt led to make any kind of monetary commitment to a ministry, let us know what the amount is and fill your name and address and tear the slip off and either drop in the offering or leave it on the literature table. And if you make any kind of monetary commitment, again, simply wait till you hear from us. We'll let you know by letter when to begin mailing it in. That'll be the only time you'll hear from us about this. Because by policy, we do not send out reminders and things of that nature. It's between you and the Lord. And again, God does supply the amount you've commit yourself to mail in. But if not, you won't be badgered by letters from us. This is how the ministry is primarily supported. And if you fill this out for any reason, such as being a mail list and so on, we'll send you some more information about the ministry. We'll send you a copy of my personal testimony in booklet form. We'll send you regularly, four times a year, this newsletter that is 12 pages, nearly 8 pages, with news of our branches and articles on Jewish customs and traditions and beliefs. But inside 4 pages is written out Bible study. Every show picks a topic in written form. You can separate from the rest and use it as God might give you the opportunity to use it. And it's free of charge. Want to receive it, simply fill this out and turn it in before you leave. Also, if you want to receive a receipt for the amount you gave or will give tonight, mark the amount in the upper left-hand corner. Well, Sister McLaughlin, so much today's offering, will be happy to send you a number of receipt for your tax records. And again, you want to make a check out, just make the check out to all your ministries. You saw some pictures of Israel, and I've been mentioning I do lead special 5-week study tours of Israel. I'll be doing one this May. At the moment, that trip is full. So if you try to, you can be put on a mailing list, but the waiting list is already a bit long. But right now the trip is full, but you can try to get on it if God opens the door. But in 2009, I'll be leading two different three-week trips. One will be with the Tommy Ice family. Many of you know him from the pre-trip conference. His two sons in particular are organizing it. I'll be doing the guiding for it. The information sheets for that tour is being printed up right now, so I don't have the copy of it with me. I'll be doing the second one in November of 2009 for 3 weeks. I do have the information sheets for that one. If you think you might want to go, then see me tonight. And then, again, I encourage you to think about coming to our special program in the summer. It's a 5-week program, but you can come for whatever free time you have, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. There are the Camp Shoshan information sheets, a lecture table, so just take one and see if you can come and join us. It'll be a time I think you'll enjoy. And if you want to sign up for any of the books or tapes or manuscripts, be sure to sign up tonight because I'll be packing those up shortly after the meeting closes. We can have the ushers come forward. We'll take our last free will offering. Boy, you're slow tonight.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, who's got the first question? Okay, we'll skip the first question. Who's got the second question? We'll come back to the first one. There it is.
Before I ask my question, I want to express my heartfelt thanks for you coming here to Austin Bible Church and blessing us with this teaching, and also for all that you do in Aerial Ministries for ministering your ministry to the Jews. Thank you very much for doing that. My question actually is kind of a technical one, and maybe this is going to seem a little bit weird, but the passage that we looked at in Jeremiah 31 that talked about the order of things, and you talked about how to actually go about destroying the Jews.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be that if you destroyed any of that, like for instance, if you were to destroy the sun, which nobody can do, but if you were to destroy the sun, would you not destroy the order of the sun and the moon and the stars and all of that just by destroying one of those things?
Well, if you destroyed the sun, you might do away with the moon and the earth, maybe.
But doesn't that destroy the order?
It won't destroy all the other stars, because the stars are collapsing all the time in this universe.
I guess what I'm trying to say is
he's just giving you an extreme example. He's
no, I know that.
Taking it too seriously.
No. No, where I'm going with this is a corollary,
yeah,
with the idea of the salvation that we have in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Where we know all the things that God did in order to provide salvation for us, his grace blessings that we receive at salvation. And if you were able to undo any of those things, you would be able to undo what he did. And certainly nobody can do that because we can't lose our salvation. But that's sort of where I was going with this, is there's a corollary in terms of our salvation, because he provided so many things at that point of salvation, but none of them can be undone. Just like in this case,
sure,
none of that order that he has established can be undone.
That's correct.
Okay.
If you destroy anything in the order there, salvation goes out the window.
Right. Thank you.
Question? Now the hands are coming up.
Do believing Jews who believe in the Lord have dual citizenship?
Believing Jews have a dual citizenship in that they're still part of Israel. They're part of because there's still a remnant today. Paul teaches Romans 11, verses 5 and 6. So even today, there's a remnant under the election of grace. The word remnant always refers to Jews who believed. A remnant is always part of Israel, not exempt from Israel. And so we are still part of Israel. We're still also, and we have a second citizenship in the church. So yes, it's a dual nationality. And actually, I'm a member of four nations. Also, I have four parts. I have the Israel, the church, United States, and Texas. And Texas is primary. Question over here.
If Satan's whole goal was to do away with the seed of the woman in the Garden of Eden, and he attempted that and failed, but then Jesus eventually came,
right?
And so he didn't succeed. But so you know, then the further genocides and attempts to kill off the Jewish people. I mean, what was his? I mean, did he just not get that Jesus came, or is it?
No, his first goal before Jesus came was to keep him from coming, mm-hmm. and while he was here, to keep him from fulfilling his messianic mission.
Mm.
But now that he knows that Jesus won't come back again, see, his career is never really over till the second coming, only then is he in the abyss. So he knows that he's got till the second coming to be active, but he also knows that there won't be any second coming till the Jews ask him to come back. So he can wipe out the Jews once and for all, there's no second coming.
Okay.
So now his goal is to avoid the second coming.
Okay.
Question? Behind you, right here?
Where?
But,
oh, okay.
I don't know how to put this. Maybe I should ask you afterwards. There's somebody else in San Antonio that is preaching to the Jews and saying that they're saved, whether they know Christ or not.
Yeah, I know what you mean. He's not preaching to Jews.
Well, that's what I mean.
He's telling Jewish people that if they've delivered according to their own covenant, they can be saved. Don't have to believe in Jesus to be saved.
How can he do that, knowing?
Well, it's called crossing into heresy.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you teach that you can be saved apart from faith in Jesus, as soon as you teach that, it's not just a matter of differences in doctrine anymore. You've crossed into heresy. Mm-hmm. You've affected salvation. And some people become so pro-Jewish that while they still believe Jesus only way, they also take a step I said yesterday or the day before, that they won't preach the gospel to the Jews, just do nice things for the Jews, but don't do the gospel, don't preach the gospel to them. Others go even further and say Jews don't need Jesus to be saved. And both of these claim to be evangelical. Neither one is, one is heretical, one is not heretical, but not evangelistic. Mm-hmm. But the best way to show love for Jesus is by sharing the gospel with them. Mm-hmm. And so in Isaiah 40, he says, comfort ye, comfort ye, my people. And in verses 10 and 11, the way he comforted them is by sharing the gospel with them.
Thank you. Can I ask one more question?
Oh, sure.
We were wondering.
We're Trinitarians. You can have three.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here's two. The general feeling right now is that the Lord's coming back soon. I mean, that's just kind of how everybody feels. And we're just thinking that, you know, when you look at the 144,000 and you see the Jewish tour guides in
yeah.
Israel that hear the gospel day after day after day, could they possibly be part of that 144,000?
If they're single. I'm serious, if they're single. 144,000 are all single males.
All single males.
So if they're married, they don't qualify.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Imminency does not mean he's coming back soon. It means nothing has to precede him coming. So immigrancy was true in the year 1000. Immigrancy was true in the year 500. So whether it's coming soon or not, I don't know. But as we can come tonight, the answer is yes. Immigrancy doesn't mean soon. It means nothing has to precede him coming.
So that means the day of the Lord is whenever.
But the day of the Lord will come only with a sign of the 7-year covenant. That's a fixed element. The rapture will come any time before that. We don't know when before that. Maybe just before, maybe some years before. We don't know.
Thanks.
Behind you over there.
During the Inquisition and times when Jews were persecuted, the convert or die, you know, thing happened, and those who converted were called Morano, or the destroyed ones. If to be a Jew, it is just to have to be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Right.
Then it's still possible to be a Jew if you're Hindu or practicing some other religion, but not if you believe in Jesus. They consider that to be destroyed, and you're no longer a Jew.
Biblically, you're a Jew if you have if the father's line is consistently Jewish. Follow? It's based upon the father's line. If at some point only your mother's Jewish, then the kids are not Jewish biblically. As far as Judaism, a Jew ceases to be a Jew if he follows any other religion. But the special antagonism is towards Jews who believe in Jesus, because Jews did not suffer massive persecution by Hindus or by Buddhists and those groups. And even the problem with the Muslims is a more recent development. The Jews have suffered the most of so-called Christianity. And that's why there is this massive antagonism to Jews believing in Jesus.
So what, a follow-up question would be, what would you say is a way to approach someone with the gospel if they believe that by believing the gospel they would be destroyed in their own Judaism?
Well, that's where you have to deal with the definition of Jewishness. What is a Jew biblically? It's not a matter of what you believe, and most Jews recognize that much, because most Jews tend to be atheistic. So it's not to say we Jews believe only one God, that too many Jews believe in no God at all, but still Jews, and so on. So you have to deal with, once you have to define what Jewishness entails, you go on from there. But to him, Jewishness is something he will lose if he becomes a Christian. That's what he's afraid of. But you have to tell him, let's define Jewishness biblically, not rabbinically. That's the difference.
Yeah, I have a follow-up on something you just said. I know some folks that their belief is that to be Jewish is to come through the mother.
That's rabbinic.
And that's rabbinic. And you just said it comes through the father. What's a good scriptural approach for that, to make that argument?
Well, the simplest spiritual approach is if it was through the mother, you would have genealogies of the woman, not the men. But it's always the male line being traced. Okay. Examples like David had two Gentile mothers in a row, Rahab and Ruth. What was he? The Bible doesn't say he was half Jewish, quarter Jewish, non-Jewish. He was a Jew because the father's line is Jewish. So it's the father's line. And then the other issue, which even rabbinic theology accepts, tribal identity is based upon who the father is. So if a father is from the tribe of Judah, the mother is from the tribe of Benjamin, the children of Judah being the tribe of Judah, not half and half. Same principle. So both tribal identity and ethnic identity is identified by the Bible. Right. Okay, so that'll be the last one here.
What verse is it that says Jesus won't come back until the Jews ask him?
The verses we looked at are Matthew 23, verses 37 through 39. Leviticus 26, verses 40 through 43. Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 12 through 18. Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 to chapter 6, verse 3. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10 to chapter 13, verse 1.
Hosea 5:15 through 6:3. Okay. Basically under the basis in your outline.
Right, basically I'm going to do two things. Number one, confess the sin of rejecting him. Secondly, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. And you say, you will not see him henceforth till you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord, which is a messianic greeting. All right, let me tell you the last two of the rabbi stories.